I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Mayors from around the world convened this week in New York to get serious about climate change. They have a growing number of examples to learn from, and one of the best is Starbucks. Tony Gale is with us today to share the groundbreaking work Starbucks is doing to make its stores green and how its work can influence others. Dr. Joe Sweeterman is director of DePaul University's Chaddock Institute, which promotes effective urban planning. Today, effective urban planning means sustainable urban planning, and the biggest chits in play are building and transportation. We'll talk about sustainability and how cities are achieving it today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. A second-generation architect, Tony Gale began his career in Seattle and then continued in many locations within the U.S., Asia, and the Middle East. After 25 years as a principal owner of three Seattle architectural firms, he was appointed by then-Seattle Mayor Paul Schell to be the city's director of architecture, engineering, and space planning, where he led the city's burgeoning national prominence as a sustainable design showplace. In 2004, Tony left his position with the city to continue creating sustainable architecture as corporate architect for Starbucks. In recognition of his achievements in sustainability, he was named an AIA Fellow in 2003. Tony, what was the driving force behind Starbucks' decision to go green in its buildings?
Well, to begin with, Carol, environmental protection is a guiding principle of the company and is a part of all of our decision-making processes across the business enterprise. But what intrigues me, and one of the reasons I've joined the company, is the sustainable platform of thinking sustainably. Orrin Smith is the most immediate past CEO of the company, and he teaches out at the University of Washington Business School. It turns out they're teaching Starbucks business techniques around the country in a lot of different universities. Orrin that morning evidently put two words on the whiteboard, ethics and business. And one of the students in the back room said, "How can you do business ethically?" And that's the reason Starbucks started down this path, is to sort of combine the two. Basically, we're an agricultural-based company. Global warming is a big deal to us. Without coffee crops, we're out of business. Buildings and building byproducts are responsible for 50% of the emissions that cause global warming. We want to create models of sustainable building in every community that we build our coffee houses within. Currently, we're turning the headquarters, what's called Silver LEED, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And we just announced a roasting plant construction down in St. Matthews, South Carolina, kind of some of part of the world that you're from, that's going to be Silver LEED. So it's a combination of things, but basically we really care about the third place experience for people, and our products, our places, and our people are really key. Today we're going to talk a little bit more about our places.
You said that you want Starbucks to be a model of sustainability for its communities. Do you think most people recognize that about Starbucks in their communities?
We think they do, especially if they care about it. And we try to make sure people understand what we're doing in that regard. So it's one of those subjects that, of course, now has turned to be very popular over the last few years. But we've been moving in this direction for a long time. And we are going to be doing more of this in terms of educating the customer within our stores with wayfinding and things of this nature that talk about sustainable concepts that we've used not only in the store, but where we have freestanding buildings on the site itself.
Do you hope that results in the customer feeling better about Starbucks? Do you hope that that results in the customer beginning to incorporate green practices, sustainable practices in their own lives? I mean, what will be the thrust of that?
Well, that's the benefit of the way we're expanding the business, because we do it sort of one small coffee house at a time, as opposed to major high-rise buildings or major public statements of signature architecture. We're a part of and want to be a part of these communities. And so answer is yes. We think it does, in a positive way, impact the customer as well as the partners that, of course, work there. They're healthier inside our stores because of the way we build out the stores, design them with low volatile organic compound materials, materials that are healthier and are quite often sourced from the region that we're building in. As a result, they stay longer. To some extent, that's a counterintuitive notion in the retail business. People want to churn folks through their facilities. We like them to stay longer and experience what's going on more than just the coffee. And we want them to take away sort of some of the notions that we build into the buildings, both in terms of building and site. Because of the size of the building, they can use these strategies on their own homes down the street or in the region itself. We want to educate the children that are with the adults coming to the coffee houses. We want to, the children got us off of smoking in general. Okay,
that's true.
They're going to move us to the next level on this subject, I think.
Although they forgot everything they taught us by the time they turn, 15?
15.
And they start smoking again.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, what is this?
But they're coming back. They're coming back. But they did. They did, if you recall, in the early 70s. They're the ones in the late 60s. They're the ones who say, stop smoking, you guys. You know, they're wearing the T-shirts. They were doing this. And they can do the same thing with greening our world and making it a better place. They can lead the way. And we want to give them the ammunition, if you will, the knowledge base, to talk about the hydrological cycles of water that relate to the site that the coffee house is on in their homes down the street. We want them to talk about photovoltaics on the roof, things that can save energy and water in the neighborhood and the community.
Tony, break it down for me. You say you expand your business one small coffee house at a time, and I want to understand what goes into going green or being sustainable at the small coffee house level. Talk about the strategies, the techniques that you use to ensure that Starbucks coffee houses are indeed green.
Well, to begin with, this last fiscal year in 2000, our fiscal year starts in October each year. We launched three interrelated initiatives designed to improve energy and environmental performance in our stores. I mean, we only purchase 2% of the world's coffee production. So the experience in the store is a big deal, and we try to look at it from a variety of points of view, and one of them is the environment. We've registered what we call our freestanding building, which is roughly a 2,000-square-foot coffee house with just under an acre site. All variations, there are 18 variations of that prototype, have been registered with the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED retail pilot.
Mm.
And then we also started just recently, in fact, last week, we've initiated what's called the Green Belt program, that will take monitoring of 20 of our stores in a variety of bioregions around the country and the world as a test bed over the next 12 months to establish a baseline to make sure we understand exactly where we are with water use, with energy use. And then we have a complementary program. The third initiative is being planned to provide 350 store managers with resource report cards for feedback directly on a real-time basis for our design teams.
Wow.
So that's a start. And it's just the beginning. It's like so many things that we're up to. It's just the beginning.
Who drives this inside Starbucks?
Well, I think it starts with Howard Schultz and Jim Donald and Martin Cole's the international president. Jim Donald's the global president. Jim Ayling, who's the North American president. They all are absolutely passionate about this idea. Ben Packard, who's the director of environmental affairs, has been driving this plane for, a good 8 years inside the company. I joined 2 years ago. And, of course, you know my background a little bit on the subject, and that's one of the reasons they brought me in to now take it to the next level, because we are doing full freestanding buildings.
Mm-hmm.
We have a high-performance building team now that's 75 partners, we call our employees partners, internationally, that are working on research for this subject, and they stretch all over the map. We get them together at least twice a month, and we have them on subject matter teams developing the research. And people are just totally excited about now the fact that we're moving into the major aspects of implementation of these programs.
That's fascinating. Separate out for me Tony, the no-brainer green building strategies from those that are more difficult and costly to do. I mean, if a retailer or someone in their own home or considering building a home or doing major renovations said, well, Starbucks is doing, you know, they've got 75 people working on the research. They're learning these things. What can we learn from them and apply pretty easily? What would those things be?
Well, first of all, I would suggest in one of the concepts we've embedded in our freestanding building prototype, it's what's called structural insulated panels, SIPs, as it's known in the industry. And these are panels that, that for the most part, don't use any solid wood frame for floors, walls, and roofs. So your frame right away can be not impacting the world's wood resource. Clear cutting in the main is caused by framing homes and light frame buildings with wood. So that's one of the things that we're doing. We're also looking and working with manufacturers of that product to help create a what we call a bio-based core inside the SIPS panel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of those pieces. We keep a direct sun off the south windows with our canopies. That way we don't have to enlarge the HVAC system to carry that heat gain. Low formaldehyde resins in our materials, low volatile organic compounds in our carpets and paint materials, things of that nature.
And are those things easy to source now, even for a consumer?
They're becoming easier. There are environmental home centers now across the country. Initially, it was due to the lack of the economy of scale. It was keeping the prices up, but that's now starting to change. We're seeing that tipping point coming in the right direction. So the more people that do this, the lower the pricing will be, much like computers or anything else of that nature. We, generally in our freestanding stores, we have 75% daylight and views. This is very important to a sustainable building, not to be in a windowless space. Forest Stewardship Council wood products that tracks the harvesting and management of the wood cutting process all the way through from the beginning to the actual source. This is something that it's a policy in the company. It's something you can do on your home now. There are millions of board feet of FSC lumber available for homeowners to use. Dual flush toilets or dual flush valves, something we've used in our Australian stores, something where you have to make the decision, one or two. And people come out of these stores, and there's a lot of other things they could talk about. That's what they talk about. We've made a decision to help the environment, save money, save water in that case. The manufacturers tell us these toilets should save something like 30% of the water use. Waterless urinals in our world headquarters in Seattle. Mm-hmm. There's no water used in the urinals, and that's what's proposed in our South Carolina roasting plant. Again, water saving. Water-resistant landscaping and landscape placing is something you can do in your home. And then stay away from air conditioning. Design the home properly so there's fresh air flowing through the home rather than having to put... If you orient the building properly, design it properly, you shouldn't have to have air conditioning. So those are some of the things homeowners can take advantage of.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Tony Gale, Director of Design for Starbucks. Let me ask you something on water-resistant landscaping. Do neighbors resist water-resistant landscaping?
So far, they haven't, because you can get pretty sophisticated with it's not just sedum that looks like a desert. You can use plants quite often that are quite native to any location in the world. There are 8 bioregions in this country, and as it turns out, about 8 bioregions in the world. Go to the tip of Florida and up to Alaska, you pretty well cover it. So we work with landscape architects in a variety of locations to make sure that as we plant, as we think about the future of these stores and the locations in the community, that they grow in a very sort of lush fashion. We want that experience to start the minute you walk on the property.
So many developers will still tell you sustainability doesn't pay. And I think that is particularly said by those developers who are not going to operate and maintain a building over time. So again, they've got to get the money out on the front end on the sale. Do you think that's true?
You hear that question a lot. In fact, I'm giving a talk on a panel in Los Angeles next week with a series of developers asking questions like that. And it depends on how much you do. A platinum LEED building certainly is going to be more expensive than a certified LEED building, the beginning level. Green design is simply good architecture and engineering and should be central to all firms' design culture. When we first passed the policy in Seattle in the year 2000, there were no green buildings, okay, in the commercial area or the public sector. With that policy, then suddenly that started to change. And if the concepts are properly integrated early in the design process and in the construction process, the cost for a green building should be about the same for a non-green building. As the economy of scale increases, then those prices will even become more in line. By integration, I mean knowledgeable design consultants, construction managers, and general contractors. A sustainable building standard. This is one of the things we're working on, Carol, with the U.S. Green Building Council, that fits the typology of the project. A standard that works for office buildings doesn't work for a little coffee house, doesn't work for a Target, doesn't work for a retail outlet. And so U.S. Green Building Council is working with retailers around the country and the world, for that matter, to try to bring some of these standards into line with the intended use. And then having an informed owner that encourages a sustainable sourcing of materials and building design, extremely important. So because their monthly operating savings, most of the retailers we talk to are committed to heading to this direction, in addition to it's the right thing to do, of course, for the planet.
You said that you're actually you said we're using healthier materials that are sourced locally.
Regionally, I meant.
Regionally. Right. Okay, locally, regionally.
Well, it's something that we've been working on hard and long, and especially in our international markets as we go into China. We are building with regional sourcing. We have a palette that we design, and then we work with our partners in that location in the world to find ways to source it in the regions that we're building the coffee houses in. We've done the same thing in Brazil just recently this last fall. And to some extent, we see it as a step process so that perhaps we can't use the post-industrial product that we're using in our counters under our counter supports. Say in Brazil, but they have another approach. They actually developed FSC lumber standards down in Brazil, and they have another approach using marine-grade plywood with resins that are moving in the right direction, so we're able to work with them.
I think this is it's really interesting to hear you say that again, you're sourcing regionally, which brings up, I guess, a question. Have you looked at the transportation flows that are required to support your business, and not so much from a customer standpoint, but from the supply chain standpoint, and looked at perhaps how you could reduce those flows and therefore reduce the impact on the environment?
In fact, we are on a regular basis. We have a very large supply chain group, as you can imagine, both nationally and internationally. We work with them elbow to elbow on all projects. They're part of the programming and design of any project that we do. They're very creative people, and they come from a lot of disciplines around the world. So, for instance, right now we're looking at what we call an alternate cladding for a freestanding building that will be a global solution to just that, providing more flexible solutions that can be sourced regionally. In the exterior skins of the building, as an example. And we're heading in that direction also in looking at infrastructure. So it's something that we're in constant conversations on. And it's a big deal. We have a open source tool that's just gone live called Pharos that was developed by the Cascadia chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council last year. And it's a material evaluation sourcing tool, basically, that allows you to evaluate tools cradle to cradle, evaluate materials cradle to cradle. And in the end, you can look at embodied water content, embodied energy content, and transportation is absolutely at the center of the issue. The net result is something that looks like an iris on an eye, and you can see where the red areas are, and that's quite often transportation. And so we're trying to reduce the transportation. We also put distribution centers in a variety of key locations around the country to make sure that we're removing as much transportation costs as possible.
And on the transportation side, while we're talking about it, do you look at that when you think about green building strategies and the impact they have? Do you take into account the location of your stores and whether they are accessible not simply to drivers of cars, but also to pedestrians and to transit riders, or as part of a multi-purpose trip?
Absolutely. This is the way we site stores. And it happens to be very sustainable, but it's also very good from a retail perspective.
Have you calculated the overall impact of your use of green strategies, savings to Starbucks and savings to the environment?
It's a work in progress. Indeed, we are. Our global president, as I mentioned, Jim Donald, has challenged all of our design teams to maintain our existing eco footprint, despite the growing from our growing from existing about 13,000 stores to up to 40,000 stores in the future. So how do you do that? And that's why our Green Belt project of monitoring, getting a real feel of the baseline of where we are right now is so important. And in addition to that, buying the wind power that we've purchased, 20% of our stores in company-operated stores in North America, all the energy comes from wind farms, to some extent down in your part of the world, in the southeast portion of the country. So those are some of the ways we're trying to get a handle on the eco footprint. We've calculated the footprint. We know what it is, and we want to keep it the same, even though we're growing substantially in the building area.
Do you have you had a mayor seek you out and say, how do you intend to do this? I need to do the same thing you're doing.
And in fact, they had me talking in a lot of locations in the world, places like Singapore and the Netherlands, about Seattle's story when I was the city architect in Seattle for 5 years, first under Paul Schell and then 2.5 years under Greg Nichols. Greg was a neighbor of mine over in West Seattle. And, he's a terrific guy. And I think that he's very courageous when it comes to these things and got out front on this issue. Along with Oren Smith and from Starbucks and Dennis Hayes, who was one of the co-founders of Earth Day originally. Dennis is here in Seattle, head of the Bullitt Foundation. Well, when Greg goes around the country now, he goes into a room, or the world for that matter, and he gets a standing ovation. So it's really taking him by surprise, as he's a very humble guy and likes to go back to West Seattle and get out of the limelight. But this is really, he's got a bull by the horns, and it's much larger than Seattle, of course, now. And so what happens is that these various mayors that do sign on quite often come in through, I'm on the board of directors of the U.S. Green Building Council, they come in through the U.S. Green Building Council and say, what does this mean? Well, we say, well, from a U.S. Green Building Council standpoint, it means that we have to certify 1 million homes and 100,000 buildings by 2010. And that's the Kyoto part of the building footprint part of the Kyoto Accords. That's a lot to get LEED certified, because there's only 500 buildings certified anywhere right now. So they start getting an indicator at that point of what that all means. And certain cities like Austin and Washington, D.C., for instance, Chicago stepped on board. New York is pushing ahead, have really caught fire on the subject. But you're right, quite often, sort of in, off the record, people will be asking me, so what does this really mean in terms of implications on cost, et cetera? Their staffs are doing a pretty good job of putting together the portfolio analysis. So they have pro forma on every one of the strategies they intend to use, whether it's green roofs or photovoltaics or whatever. So it's just one of those things. It's like when flight was discovered. This is the largest sea change in the construction industry, design industry, since the Bauhaus of the 30s. And so, you just have to say, we really don't quite know where we're headed generally as a civilization yet with this subject. All we need to know is it needs to happen. Let's go do it.
Tony, I on a lighter note, I have to ask you, what's the oddest conversion you've ever done for a Starbucks location?
Well, I think there are a couple. They're both down in Oregon. Interesting. One's in Gresham, Oregon. It's called it was a Hot and Now. We debranded and rebuilt. I remember our teams went in there the first time to take a look at the building after we purchased the chain. And turned out the building was built in two halves. Inside the building that was the shell, there was this basically a mobile home that had been welded together. And so we had to undo it. And we've rebuilt it, and now we've added, it was at the end of its life at that point, and we extended another 15 years of life to the building. So that was an odd one. And then elsewhere in the Portland area, there were three Spunkies donut shops that we did. And these guys look like coffee cups. You know, you think, well, that's an easy transition for Starbucks. Well, kind of, but they had this weird sort of rebar a frame that looked like a coffee cup and wire mesh on top of it. And so a quirky sort of art deco situation. And we converted, you know, we've saved the character of the building, but we took off the rebar and the wire mesh and donated them to a local charity. So anyway, those are some fun Spunky.
Well, Tony, I appreciate the work you're doing. And thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
You bet. Thank you for having me, Carol.
Tony Gale, corporate architect for Starbucks. You're listening to Smart City. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's assistant editor, Nate Berg.
America's public schools are big institutions. They're big because almost every state in the union has acreage requirements that keep them big. But a movement is gradually gaining momentum that looks to reduce or eliminate those acreage requirements in an effort to create more compact schools. New Urban News reports that since 2003, the states of Rhode Island, Maine, and South Carolina have tossed out these requirements for all new schools. South Carolina's governor, Mark Sanford, reasoned that by creating smaller schools, it would be easier to acquire the land to place them in existing neighborhoods. This, he said, would reduce the development of schools on the outskirts of towns, which has made the students in many states dependent on cars to get them to and from school. With the Environmental Protection Agency now looking into plans to help state officials reduce the sizes of their schools, other states may soon follow suit. In suburban Chicago, homeowners are joining forces to defend their communities from a proposed new addition to their neighborhoods. One they fear will threaten their very security. But it's not a casino or a Walmart. It's not even low-income housing. The threat these homeowners fear is a sidewalk. The Chicago Tribune reports that hundreds of residents in rural neighborhoods have signed petitions opposing local plans to build sidewalks in some neighborhoods. Many of those opposed argue that the whole reason they moved to the suburbs was to enjoy their neighborhood's rural feel. They say sidewalks are not necessary and will bring all kinds of negative impacts to their communities. Of the most concern to residents is the impression that these sidewalks will act as welcoming mats to potentially dangerous strangers who are allowed, even encouraged, to walk into their neighborhoods. And finally, a citywide ban on outdoor advertising has been in place since the beginning of the year in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And for the city's residents, the change has been a little weird. NPR's On the Media recently interviewed a reporter from Sao Paulo's largest newspaper about the new ad-free experience, and he said it is like living in a whole new city. Areas formerly covered up by billboards and digital signs are now revealed to the public, which at times is noticing some things about its city for the first time. For example, to the surprise of many, huge shanty towns that were formerly under the cover of advertisements are now out in broad sight. And while the advertising industry is obviously complaining, the city's residents have shown broad support for what has ultimately been referred to as a citywide cleanup effort. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk to Dr. Joe Sweeterman, director of DePaul University's Chaddock Institute, about sustainable urban planning. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Joe Sweeterman is director of DePaul University's Chaddock Institute, which promotes effective urban planning. He's professor of public service management and a noted authority on transportation. He's a longstanding contributor to the Transportation Research Board, a unit of the National Academy of Sciences. His most recent work includes a book about the abandonment of American railroads entitled When the Railroad Leaves Town, American Communities in the Age of Rail Line Abandonment. Joe, the Urban Land Institute just released a report that says our airports, our roads, our rail, our bridges, and other transit infrastructure are deteriorating because of insufficient investment. Do you agree?
I do. And in fact, I think right now the average American is starting to feel that. You know, I grew up in the early days of the interstate highway system where mile a minute you could get anywhere. We had airports were empty, and we still had some of the great trains. And I think now we're feeling the effects that we're maxed out. And that's been a wake-up call. We've felt it in the cities for quite some time, but now smaller towns are feeling that. And I think it's finally getting the attention of our congressmen, but unfortunately it's still being squeezed out by health care and other issues that are just a little more politically sexy right now, you might say.
How did we get to this point?
Well, we basically are giving a great legacy by the generations before us that put big percent of our gross national product into infrastructure. And don't forget, we have private railways out there that are handling an enormous amount of freight without a dollar of federal money. But now we've reached a point. I mean, our country's population is growing. We crossed 300 million. People are driving more. We virtually have universal car ownership. And so it's time to build some more infrastructure. And that's tough because we're also not in my backyard kind of country. So some hard politically sensitive issues are going to be raised.
So you're saying it's an issue of both money and decision making.
It is. It is. And I think the good news here is that a lot's happening right now. I think all of us in this field just feel a sense of excitement right now that we have. Airports are expanding. I mean, here in Chicago, we're launching probably the biggest airport expansion project in U.S. history. We see states are anting up for more passenger trains. We're seeing some movement. And I tell you, after 9/11, things seem pretty grim, but there's a sense of momentum right now.
I read where Governor Schwarzenegger is advocating high-speed rail in California. Is that to be state-funded?
He is. We just finished a really interesting study to look at all the proposals for high-speed trains in the U.S. And here we're talking U.S.-style high-speed, like 110 mile per hour or more. And we find these little proposals are bubbling up around the country. And I think the bad news is none of them have really gotten the push they need to be, you know, massive amounts of state funding. But, you know, the Acela train out east, which runs at 150 on Amtrak, is our first high-speed train, and I think has shown America that we can do this. And Governor Schwarzenegger's announcement this week shows California may come to the plate with something much more ambitious. But those of us who've been watching it a while are celebrating the smaller initiatives. You know, we have trains in Michigan now that are hitting 110 mile per hour. We have Philadelphia to Harrisburg. They just started last summer, 110 mile per hour service there. So the signs, the stars appear to be aligning, as Amtrak's president said, for a bit of resurgence in rail.
Is Amtrak the right agency to do this?
You raise a really interesting question because I'm pretty involved with some of the high-speed rail efforts, and there's no issue that will split the audience quicker than saying, if we put big money into passenger rail, can we afford to turn to Amtrak to do this? Or should we look at, say, what England has done with Virgin Rail, Richard Branson's company is at the table? And it's a really tough call. And unfortunately, Amtrak is the only railroad that can run over the tracks of freight railroads. So a lot of people say, unless it's Amtrak, you know, we're going to be waiting a long time. But I think Amtrak knows this. And there's a sense of we're going to have to see some new types of business models to make true, efficient, high-speed service work in the U.S. And we're all pretty optimistic that Amtrak or another operator is going to bring to the table some new opportunities.
How do you reconcile the federal government's attitude toward rail and specifically Amtrak and what you see needing to be done and the promise of that?
It is pretty exciting right now, and it's easy to get depressed when we talk passenger rail because, you know, Amtrak has been here 30-some years and we have yet to see a breakthrough. But let's not forget that this year in Congress, there's a proposal marching through not only to fund Amtrak, but to give states a pool of money to apply toward matching their own efforts. If they want to build high-speed trains from Chicago to St. Louis, there could be federal money to match that. And that's kind of the grand compromise. So the Bush administration wanted to get rid of Amtrak and move all toward this state-driven approach. But now there's a sense that maybe we can do both. And the passenger numbers this year are just great. We're seeing 50% growth in some of the Illinois markets here, and it doesn't hurt certainly to have $3 gas prices. It's there's a little momentum right now.
Going back to the ULI report, it described a very big problem. Do you know the scope of the problem?
Well, our public transit systems really have come to a critical fork in the road, and I think the distressing thing here, at least in Chicago, is we know the system needs money. We're not finished arguing, though, how much reform we need before we put more money in the system. And I think we have to have both, and we have to have it fast. And the good news is the ridership numbers are growing. The bad news is, you know, the system is literally falling apart. And that's a tough proposition to sell when suburbanites see public transit once again as a bit of a sinkhole. But now that service has declined on some of the routes, we're hearing complaints. We're seeing real pressure in Springfield, our capital here, to take action for some new innovation and some new funding. And we're seeing that around the country as well.
The ULI study addressed maintenance, but we see so many new systems being built, especially in places that you wouldn't expect, cities in the South, cities in the West, that are investing in new light rail systems. So is it easier to get money for new systems, but then you can't maintain them? That's not as sexy?
Yeah, it's funny. Both sides kind of envy each other. Wow, why can't we have that? We got pedestrian access to transit everywhere. We got systems. We here in Chicago and the eastern cities look out west and say, gee, in the last 10 years, we're seeing Los Angeles, San Diego, we're seeing light rail in Portland, we're seeing Denver light rail, Seattle commuter rail. It just, things are happening really quickly. And I think the lesson in that, and I was in Brussels talking to some European folks, is they're saying transit needs to continue to improve just to hold on to what it has. And I think that's what we're seeing in Chicago. Transit's got to get faster. It's got to be more friendly and efficient just to hold on to its market share. And the opportunity is there. It's just we as a country haven't really demanded it yet. We haven't insisted to our politicians like they do in Europe that we have to have first-class alternatives to the automobile. And that pressure, I think, is starting to – the politicians are feeling that now.
In America, most transportation-related infrastructure is paid for by whom?
Well, that's a great question that will anger people wherever you go, because the rail people look to highways and say this is not a fair game. That rail freight, I mean, think about it. Our big carriers, Union Pacific and CS, are paying major league property tax on their property, and they're competing with truckers who operate over subsidized roads and everything else. The airport question is a little more difficult because we all pay some pretty hefty user fees, and the airport system is in some ways self-sustaining, but there's kind of these hidden subsidies that go to airports. So we haven't really leveled the playing field, and unfortunately, I think it's pretty obvious that the automobile is the biggest beneficiary of the public largesse, and that's really hurt the freight hauling railroads.
If you could change the mix of our transportation funding, our transportation investment, how would you change it?
Well, I think, first of all, we need some kind of commitment to create something like our interstate highway system for the railroads. And there's people talking about that we need corridors that are free of highway crossings that can just move massive amounts of freight to get these trucks off the road. And we're all feeling the effects of that. There's safety issues, and that's only going to get worse. I think on the airport side of things, I do think that we're seeing more and more use of user fees at the airports, the facility charges you all pay in your ticket, which we don't like to pay, of course, but it's served to give our airports a source of funding that's allowed them to modernize without appealing to the federal government. We don't have something quite like that for highways yet. We're so cautious about using tolls, and I know this is a real sensitive topic for people because we like free roads, but we also don't like congested roads, and roads that are falling apart. And unfortunately, until we find a way to charge for the use of highways to make people use the system more efficiently, we're going to have these kind of problems.
Where do the big trucking firms come down on this question?
Well, it's funny enough. Trucking companies are coming around in that there's millions being lost in congestion. And the big rage right now are truckways, where we could – maybe we don't have the political will to build a brand new highway through a metro area. We believe me, we need new highway systems as well as transit. So we're not – we're talking a balance here. But truckers – you can build truckways, you know, along railway lines. They don't need to be have access points every mile or two. And so there's some talk, if we could create these roads, truckers may pay $10 or $20, you know, for a use of a truckway across a metropolitan area. And that may be a way to get highways without the difficult task of relocating people and 10 years of public hearings on where the road's going to be. And that's kind of new in our field.
But railroads own those corridors, right?
Yeah, and railroads, funny enough, freight railroads we're talking here, have always had kind of the distrust for government. And then the view is kind of leave us alone. You want to help us, thanks. We know there's a downside if we take your help. So they kind of have a bit of a bunker mentality. But now that railroads and truckers are partners in many ways, we all see the containers going across the country. And it's more of a – they're in the business of getting – commodities from A to B, and they use different modes, they're more willing to play the game when we talk about working with trucking companies than 20 years ago, where they just where they were enemies, if you will.
Many cities are now leasing their toll roads to private investors. Is that a good deal for taxpayers?
Well, I can tell you, it's we need to just start with the premise that our highway trust fund is pretty much broke. We promise more road maintenance than we have money for. So the question is, what are we going to need to do to build new highways and to modernize, you know, what we have in transit? And nobody knows where the money's coming from. They're arguing that in Congress now, and I had testified, and I can tell you I took it on the chin from some congressmen who felt that, you know, leasing these roads, you're selling our future and so forth. But we also know that we need to get moving with expansion quickly. And there are ways to make these work that protect the public. But this is, you know, very emotional. Indiana, I tell you, you want to hear an uproar, look at Indiana where they tried this. And they leased the Illinois Tollway, but another road, public said, no way. If you're building a highway, it's going to be free. And, you know, unfortunately, that's just going to mean less construction if we aren't willing to entertain those kind of options.
Your goal at the Chaddock Institute is to promote effective urban planning. What do you consider to be the most urgent issues in urban planning today?
Well, I'm partisan to transportation, as you know, and I do think highway congestion is the one thing that binds all this together, that we promote smart growth and transit-oriented development, and we sort of take a view of urban sprawl that whether or not environmentally where you stand, we all agree that the aesthetics of some of this urban expansion just could use some help, you know, strip malls as far as you can see. But highway congestion is the one thing that pulls planners and economic development people and others under the same tent, saying we got to find a way to lay out cities that allow people to feel a sense of at ease of travel. And I can tell you that's here in Chicago, just in the last few years, everybody can relate to that message.
But for a long time, while we agreed that highway congestion was the problem, it seemed like the only solution was to build more highways.
Yeah, and we're finally beyond that. We know that if we build roads, we have to find ways to make sure they're used wisely, you know, be it tolls or be it a different revenue. And we have to fund transit at the same time. And you know, just here in the city, we have three or four really exciting transit proposals that are waiting for their boost. And I think we're seeing around the country when there's state efforts to fund transportation, now they're tying all this together, which is new. It's not the famous highway pavement lobby battling against the cities. There's kind of a plan, and California is kind of leading the way on this, I think, where they're really successful, and they're adding Amtrak services to all these routes, and it's not seen as a us highway versus rail kind of issue. It's we just got lots of people that want quality of life, and we got to invest in the downtowns, and all that does kind of fit together. And you know, somebody who grew up in rural Ohio and now in Chicago, I can just see that that in the Midwest here, we have just sort of taken for granted some of the urban development patterns that, you know, consume lots of land and condemn us to a life of driving from strip mall to strip mall. People are wanting more than that. Incomes are rising. People want aesthetics. They want smart development patterns to be in touch with nature. And that's new to our region. What we see in California is coming to the Midwest every year.
Are there issues emerging you think may vex us in the future?
Lots of things. And I can tell you the fuel price thing, we're just coming to grips with what $3.50 fuel means to us. We're also seeing just how living patterns are changing now, where instead of people living in the distant suburbs and driving downtown, you know, now they're moving to the prairie and driving to the distant suburbs. So cities are just fanning out. And a lot of people who felt they were in a part of town where they were close to the edge now see that they're in this urban expanse that's going to, you know, grow without boundaries. And they're paying attention now. So it isn't quite city versus suburb anymore. It's a general sense that we need to take some smart steps to live in ways that put us in touch with the countryside and with natural amenities that are about to be lost.
Are there opportunities developing to improve the places we live that are not yet generally recognized?
Well, we're talking here in downtown Chicago, and just walking over here today, you just feel the magic that's happening down here. We have a residential boom. My students right now are looking at all the residential towers going up and just saying, this is really remarkable. When I started at DePaul in 91, you know, downtown cleared out at 5 o'clock, and Chicago is a case study of how a growing population, we're not just talking empty nesters and retirees and people without kids. We're talking about whole populations now that are taking a real interest in urban living. And you look around the country, New York is feeling that, Boston, San Francisco. And I think it's spreading gradually to the smaller cities, you know, to the Clevelands and to the St. Louis's. And it isn't going to, of course, stop our concerns about decentralization and sprawl, but it's great to see that once again the central city is a magnet that can help coordinate some of our planning efforts. And I can tell you, at least 10 years ago, we didn't feel that excitement.
Dr. Joe Sweeterman is director of DePaul University's Chaddock Institute. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Think the weather is bad where you live? City View's commentator Walker Smith has some news for you.
Lightning strikes the earth 100 times a second, 24 hours a day. On average, 30% of the earth is covered by clouds at any given time. A lot of those clouds gather over Mount Wailea on the island of Kauai in Hawaii, which averages 460 inches of rain each year, making it the wettest spot on Earth. But Cherrapunji, a town of 30,000 people in northeast India, holds the world's record for the most rainfall over a 12-month period. 1,042 inches fell from August 1860 to July 1861, which is the equivalent of 75 years of rain for San Jose, California. In just one day, June 16, 1995, it rained 62 inches in Cherrapunji. Thinking about that much rain can make you break out into a cold sweat. But Death Valley, California just makes you sweat, period. Death Valley used to hold the record for the all-time hottest temperature of 134 degrees Fahrenheit on July 10, 1913. But 11 years later, on September 13, 1922, a temperature of 136 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded in the Sahara Desert at Azizia, Libya, a record that still stands to this day. The place on Earth with the record for the all-time coldest temperature is the Russian Vostok station in Antarctica. Unofficially, a temperature of minus 132 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded during the winter of 1997. This is colder than dry ice. but the official record at Vostok is minus 128.6 degrees Fahrenheit on July 21, 1983. These are the kinds of strange weather facts I repeat to myself when it rains on me at the beach, or when snow delays my flight out of LaGuardia, or when the winds die while I'm out sailing in the San Juan Islands. I say to myself, things could be worse, you know. The first time I went on a river trip through the Grand Canyon, it rained nonstop for the first week. Temperatures plunged to the 30s. The winds kept howling upstream all day long while we got splashed in one rapid after another by the 45-degree river water that comes from the middle of Lake Powell behind the Glen Canyon Dam. It snowed on the south rim that week, and we got our share of that weather, too. I was miserable and unhappy. One morning, as I stumbled out of my tent into yet another cold, stinging drizzle, I saw one of the guides, Bronco, standing by the river, staring downstream as the gray clouds began to lighten from the rising sun above them. I walked up to him and started to grouse about another nasty day. But without acknowledging my complaint, he interrupted me and declared, "Hey, Walker, it's the start of another great day in the Grand Canyon." Standing there, cold and wet, I suddenly realized that Bronco was right. Even in bad weather, it's still the Grand Canyon. A little rain, or even a lot, couldn't change that. Rain or shine, the Grand Canyon is still a beautiful place. So is life, by the way. Clouds come and go. The heat and the cold pass by, too. But whatever the weather, life is still a buzzling, dazzling carnival with something beautiful every day. So nowadays, when it rains on me at the beach, I pack up my towel, fold up my chair, close up my cooler, and then I take a walk. After all, it's still a beautiful place. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.